Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the animator Nick Park. Wallace and Gromit are his most celebrated characters. Gromit, the silent but wise dog. Wallace, his well-meaning owner with notably less brain power. Surely the only movie star these days confident enough to wear a hand-knitted tank top and drive a bread van. His creations are, yes, old-fashioned, archetypally British and the antithesis of cool, but his success is international. His first Oscar win was in 1990 with Creature Comforts. In a scene that wouldn't have been out of place in one of his films, he forgot to pack a bow tie for the ceremony, so ended up cobbling one together from wrapping paper and sellotape. He says of Wallace and Gromit, "I do love their characters. They're like my children. I love to see them doing well out there in the real world." You've been called Nick Park, Preston's answer to Walt Disney. I'm wondering if you've got any plans for a Wallace and Gromit theme park. The rides would be good, wouldn't they, surely?
Yeah, well, we are actually at the moment in discussions with a theme park.
Are you?
We are in the middle of discussions with Blackpool Pleasure Beach about a Wallace and Gromit ride, yeah.
Where better to have it than Blackpool Pleasure Beach? And yeah. In terms of, I appreciate, you know, negotiations are a delicate thing, but can you give us any clues as to what form the ride might take?
Well, it's not a hair-raising, terrifying ride. It's a kind of family-friendly ride, and it's nice because it's a family-run business, and they're very local. You know, Blackpool is just down the road. I used to go there as a kid for the switching on of the lights, and it feels right.
I can hear the queues forming as we speak. What a wonderful prospect. So you've got four Oscars, that's right.
And you've had
a BAFTA for every single movie that you've made. I know somebody who interviewed you once and said he really did bring his Oscar out of a shopping bag.
That's right. That was the first time back in 1990 when Creature Comforts won. Well, they don't give you anything to put it in. And I think my mum sewed together a bag when I got home. That's all I had was a Woolworths carrier bag and stuck it in the suitcase.
You, of course, create these wonderful miniature worlds of, you know, tea strainers and anti-macassars and Jacob's cream crackers. I'm wondering what your real world is like. Do you drive a Maserati and use an iPad? Or are you quite a nostalgic character yourself?
Yeah, I have a bed that kind of tips up and tips me down through the sunroof of the car. Well, I think my PA would like that because then I'd be on time for meetings.
And a machine to put your shirt sleeves on.
That's right. Talking of vehicles, though, I have a VW camper van, and that's kind of my pride and joy at the moment. And I love all the, you know, the pop-top roof and, right, you know, the things that fold out and that kind of thing.
It is, I mean, that world that we take with us on the road in you know, things like the Volkswagen camper and so on, it's quite a miniature world. Do you quite... You feel quite at home in those small recreated worlds.
Yes, I do. I do like a limited world. I don't like living in big open spaces and in terms of a house.
A Matter of Loaf and Death was your most recent film. That was 30 minutes long. How long did it take to make?
That was about 8 months.
So how many seconds, I mean, you do measure it in seconds, I'm guessing. How many seconds a day on average would you be getting down on film?
Well, one animator working with one puppet would probably do about 3 seconds a day, 2.5 to 3 seconds a day on average. It can vary a great deal. On a feature film, there'd be 25 to 30 animators, and each one of them would be doing about 3 seconds a day. So it's actually, you know, the rushes at the end of the week are, you know, there's quite a few...
Run into the minutes.
Quite a few seconds. We kind of open a bottle of champagne if we achieve a minute within a week.
Let's have some music then. What are we going to hear first of all this morning, Nick Park?
A good old favourite, which is Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel.
And why do you like this?
I remember it at discos in the 70s, and it seemed so timeless. Come and see me, make me smile. I'll do what you want, running wild. There's nothing left, all gone. And run away. Maybe you'll tarry for a while.
That was Steve Harley and Make Me Smile. You've been described, Nick Park, as the most unusual man in the British movie industry. What do you make of that?
Unusual? I don't know.
Compliment or not?
Who said that?
I'm not sure who said it, actually.
I suppose that's nice. I mean, I don't know in what way, though.
Well, I suppose you're not the archetypal slick movie person, are you? You don't appear to have an ego the size of the Isle of Man. You're not wearing a very sharp suit, although your clothes are nice. You're not that big person who wants to be noticed. I mean, a lot of movie people are like that.
No, although it's funny. I mean, I've always been quite ambitious in a way, in a quiet sort of way. But what's in a way nice for me is that I've never felt I have to kind of get out there and sell myself and, you know, big myself up. And
yes,
it's nice that the work speaks for itself, you know, I hope.
Do you think then, I mean, you must surely have in what is a very competitive industry and one that demands huge amounts of hard work and dedication, you must have a sort of bit of a core of steel running through you to have gotten this far. Very determined.
I was. I mean, I remember, you know, because I started making films as a kid. I used to often think to myself, you know, as a teenager, if I watch TV, you know, if I just watch anything that comes on the TV, I'm just never going to do anything. And so I used to get back up into the attic and carry on making, almost like pushing myself, really.
And you were one of five children. Now when I read that about you, I was quite surprised, because I sort of had you down in rather a clichéd way, more fool me, as probably an only child. So were you,
really?
were you creating a nice quiet corner for yourself in the house by going up into the attic?
I probably was. I mean, the house is always very busy. I was the middle one of five children.
Mm.
My mother tells me I was the quietest one, and I spoke very late because I think my older brothers used to speak for me. But I always felt, I guess, like the invisible one. I was told as well that I used to, even though I was quiet, I would observe people and I would go away and draw. I loved drawing, and I could sit on my own quietly and draw for hours. I loved being in my own world.
When did your love affair with the Beano start?
That was another. Yeah, I used to, probably I was about 7 years old and got the Beano every Thursday. I used to love being off school ill because I could just sit there in my bed and just read a pile of old Beanos. I'm just remembering a Christmas day about 1967 when there was a cardboard box from one of the presents, and I remember sitting in that box nearly all day and reading my new annual, Beano annual, from cover to cover.
What a perfect day.
It was, actually.
Let's have some more music then. We're on disc number two now. What are we going to hear next?
Yeah, we're going to hear one from Neil Young. It's a very sad one, actually, called Four Strong Winds. My fellow animator on The Wrong Trousers, Steve Box, I remember him playing this a lot. And I was animating a scene of a very sad scene of Gromit leaving home and being with his tears welling up in his
very
eyes.
Very sad. It's when he's been forced out by the penguin.
Yeah, that's right. And as an animator, you are really an actor. You're taking on the character in your own body, and you sort of have to somehow imbue character, you know, into the clay.
Yes.
And so I used to listen to this record to just get myself into a sad state of mind, to get myself into Gromit's state of mind, basically.
Think I'll go out to Alberta. Weather's good there in the fall. I got some friends that I could go to work in for. Still, I wish you'd change your mind. If I ask you one more time, what we've been through this 100 times.
That was Neil Young and Four Strong Winds, and powerful memories there, Nick Park, of making Gromit sad in The Wrong Trousers. Your mother was a seamstress, your mother who made the bag for the Oscar,
and
your father was an architectural photographer.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that you inherited the creativity from both?
Yes, I mean, my dad passed away 10 years ago, but yeah, he was very active in photography, wood carving, building things, and my mother is still, you know, very active with making stuff for the village fair. I always feel very grateful, really, for a very happy childhood. Rainy days, you know, were never boring. In fact, people would come to our house because my mum and dad would always supply us with tons of paper, or, you know, we'd make giant papier-mâché monsters and In a way, it was like an ethos, really. My granny used to say, you know, if you're good at something, you should use it. You know, you should just go and do it.
One of the reasons that parents often aren't encouraging is because of the amount of mess it creates. I'm imagining if there were five children doing things and five children's friends in the house doing things and your parents also doing things. I mean, did you live in a huge, rambling house?
Well, no, actually. It sounds like, you know, the Addams Family or something. But we lived in a 1960s bungalow, really, which is where my mum lives now. And it was a bungalow with an upstairs. So I shared a bedroom with three brothers. But we had a big garden shed where my dad, that was his domain.
What was there a touch of the amateur inventor about your father?
Yeah, there was very much, actually. In fact, after making a grand day out, you know, where Wallace builds this rocket in the basement of his house, I remember thinking after I'd made that I've actually made a film about my dad. Because I remember we bought this old, decrepit, like 1960s caravan from someone for about £10. And we got it home and my parents stripped it down to the chassis and built this kind of wooden box on it, which was a caravan with wallpaper inside and bunk beds and lots of things that fold out. And it was a little home from home, really, that seven of us went on holiday to North Wales in. we used it for 2 or 3 years, I think, and it was like a square box.
And but, there were seven people living in it?
Yeah, yeah.
Cramped. And
we took a tent as well.
Right.
Yeah, we camped in a field in North Wales. And I've got a cine film of it somewhere.
Have you? When did the filming start? Because did your mother have a cine camera?
That's right. My dad bought it for my mum as a present. And I remember one of the first things they said was, you know, you kids should take this camera and get out there and make films, you know, do things with it. I think very early I latched onto it and I started turning my cartoons into animation, either by flipbooks or making paper cutouts out of them or felt cutouts from my mum's scrapbox.
When did you make Walter the Rat? There was a film that wasn't there.
That was about then, about 1972. I had my own character called Walter the Rat, which I drew on all my school notebooks and everything. But I had this ambition to... how great would it be one day to have my characters out there, the famous, I guess. And it was a secret ambition. I would never tell anybody about it because it felt kind of... You shouldn't want to do that kind of thing.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear now? We're on disc number 3.
Oh, yeah, my next choice is Elvis Costello and Every Day I Write the Book.
And why this track?
Well, it really reminds me of my National Film School student days in London. This was in the charts around then. I love songs with great lyrics, and he's just one of those. He's a poet, you know, he's a very clever songwriter.
That's Elvis Costello and Every Day I Write the Book. You said, Nick Park, that was chosen mainly because it reminded you so much of your time at film school.
Mm.
It must have seemed like a very ambitious thing to do, to apply to film school. After all, as you said, it didn't seem a realistic thing that you could have a career doing drawing and making plasticine things. And yet there you ended up. Was it tough to get in?
It was easy, you know, in the sense that I got it.
They don't take on many animators.
No, and I guess, you know, coming from Preston, I always felt very, you know, what am I doing here? You know, people from Preston don't go to film school, you know. I was so overawed by going there and, you know, the number one place in the country to study film.
And that was when you started making a grand day out, was it, while you were still at film school?
It was. Oh, yes, gosh.
You said that when you finished a grand day out, it came out in 1989, that you realised you'd made a film about your father.
Mm.
Sometimes when I'm animating Wallace, I see my father there in his eyes.
Tell me
more about that.
It's true. I mean, in his attitude, he would often just get an idea and disappear into the shed. And, you know, you'd hear all the banging, cartoon sawing and drilling. And 2 days later, he would come out with a big cabinet or shelf or something, or bunk bed, you know.
This idea of seeing him in the character's eyes, though, is interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, are they actually... I would say plasticine. Is it actually plasticine they're made of?
It is. It's good old-fashioned plasticine. Yeah.
Yes. So the idea that you can embody, which you do so brilliantly, so much personality in little plasticine figures. How do you capture the spirit?
Yes, well, on one level, every model maker I work with, they often can be accused of making models look like themselves. If you take Morph, for example, which was created by my business partners, Peter Lord and Dave Sproxton, who set up the company back in the 70s.
This is Aardman.
Aardman, yeah, yes. And they created Morph. I can tell if Pete's animated Morph, or I can tell if one of the other animators has animated it, because it takes on their personality.
When you were an impoverished, struggling filmmaker, is it true that you asked Plasticine to send you some free stuff?
Oh, that's right. I was planning a grand day out, and, you know, as a student, after any kind of freebie, and I wrote to what was then Harbert's Plasticine, and I said, could you give me some plasticine, expecting a few packets, if I give you a credit on the end of the film? And they just said, how much can you carry? And so I took a van and loaded up about half a ton of plasticine.
Half a ton?
Which was very generous of them.
It certainly was. Where did you store it?
I think I'm still using it, actually.
What colour was it? Because it comes in different colours, doesn't it?
It does. It came in 10 different colours.
So you had a selection. They didn't give you a half a tonne block of brown.
No, that would have been...
Yeah, that would have been unfortunate.
I'd have had a lot for Gromit's ears and Wallace's trousers. I'm not even sure we're allowed to call it plasticine.
Yes,
now,
we should say that other modelling clays are available. Yes, and equally as good, given that we're on the BBC. I'm wondering if they hadn't sent you this huge half-ton block in 10 different colours, if you wouldn't have ended up sort of doing finger puppets or something else. Do you think your path of animation might have changed?
No, I don't think so, because I always feel that, you know, the plasticine or the clay is really important. And Gromit, for example, was born, I think, out of the medium itself. I always remember coming to do the first shot in A Grand Day Out, where Wallace is sawing through a plank and is using Gromit as like a trestle.
Yes, I remember.
To support the plank. Yes. You know, Gromit's looking pretty hacked off, really. And I was actually planning to give Gromit a mouth, and I found it so difficult to change his mouth that I just moved his brow up and down. And it was in that moment, out of economy or laziness, I don't know, but suddenly his character was born. Yes. And I realised he could say everything. And I hadn't predicted that at all. I didn't know that was going to happen. So I like that. I like the way you discover things as you go.
Let's have some more music. We're on number four now.
Oh, yes.
What is it we're going to hear?
We're going to hear The Proclaimers and Sunshine on Leith. I love that rawness that they have. I like when songs have double meanings, and, you know, it's kind of a love song, but it's also got a kind of spiritual element as well.
That was The Proclaimers and Sunshine on Leith. You have, Nick Park, of course, had this long and hugely successful professional relationship with Peter Sellis, the actor who is the voice of Wallace. It began very early on. It began, indeed, when you were at film school. You wrote to him? You called him up?
Yes. I knew him from Last of the Summer Wine, of course, as Cleggy. So, yeah, I wrote to him, and he was very, very kind. And actually, I only had 50 quid. You know, to pay an actor at the time. So he was doing it really as a favour for a student.
Yes.
And he offered to come out and to the film school and record for a day, which was what we did. And I'd never directed a proper actor before, so I was quite nervous.
And did he just do it, or did you have to say, no, when you say Wensleydale, can you say it like this? Or did he just sort of...
There was a bit of that. I told him how I'd like him to say Gromit, to really sound the T as Gromit. I remember telling him that.
And why was that important?
I think it's because I had this in mind that he would use his teeth. I designed Wallace with a very heavy row of bottom teeth, and I wanted him to sound his teeth. But I didn't know his mouth was going to go that wide, and it's really the way that Peter said, cheese! You know, cheese, Gromit! That suddenly made his mouth go very wide.
It was quite a while before you troubled him again, was it not?
It was. I did that morning's recording, and then... It took me another 7 years to complete the film. I was partly on my own doing it at the National Film School, and then Aardman offered me work, and, you know, I was working on Morph and things like that, and that's why it took a few years to finish it.
So he was in his early 50s when you started working with him, and he'll be 90 next year.
Yes.
You know, is it a very close working relationship?
It is. I mean, he's been lovely, actually. We have a very close working relationship.
And how collaborative is it then? Is he very much still the actor who comes in and reads your words, or does he tell you when he thinks, you know, I'm not sure Wallace would do that?
Yeah, he does have his opinions.
How does that go then?
A lot of the time, I mean, Wallace is just shouting, "Gromit!" You know. But I remember showing him the storyboard of Wrong Trousers and he was doing all this, "Gromit!" You know, shouting and stuff. And then he said, why doesn't he just get off the train?
He's missing the point, I think. Yes. You won your first Oscar then for Creature Comforts. I mean, the bow tie being made out of sellotape and wrapping paper.
Yes.
Was that a stunt? Or did you really forget your bow tie?
I didn't have one with me. I was going to get one while I was there. That was the plan.
Right.
But there was no time in the end. So I nipped out to a newsagent around the corner and bought like 60 cents worth of some elastic and some wrapping paper and some sellotape, and just made this bow tie very quickly. And I thought, well, it's the Oscars, I'm an animator, do something a bit larger than life, a bit cartoony. And I actually didn't realise how big it was. I turned up with this massive green bow tie on. And, you know, LA, people loved it. It didn't look that out of place, really.
The Oscar ceremony itself, then, you are given lots of tips and instructions about what a winner should and should not do. At the moment that the Oscar goes to is read out, and the Oscar goes to Nick Park for Creature Comforts.
Oh, yes.
What's the feeling?
Oh, gosh, utter and complete dread. It was like an out-of-body experience, really. I was just so nervous. Well, also, I had two films nominated. I'd come from nowhere and suddenly had Creature Comforts and Grande Out just got finished at the same time by chance. And I was nervous that if I did win, I might thank the wrong set of people. When I see footage of myself, I look just so nervous and just dying to get off stage, basically.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear next?
Oh, yeah. This next one is one of my favourite comedians, really, and writes very funny songs. It's John Shuttleworth, Fleece the World.
God bless the fleas, it brings you inner peace. I can't conceive of a finer outer garment. I'm surprised that the police haven't championed the fleas for constables on the beat or even the sergeants.
That was John Shuttleworth and Fleece the World. There was a point then when Aardman Animations went into partnership with a big American studio. It was DreamWorks, and you made very successfully Chicken Run, which, can you remember how much money Chicken Run took at the box office?
I think it was $160 million or something.
Having cost around about 40-odd million to make. So that was, that's good business. And then there was The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. That was in 2005.
Yes.
Were you filled with trepidation at the thought of working with these big Hollywood players?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm constantly kind of in awe, really, of how things have gone, you know, from playing with plasticine at home. And that's what I still feel I'm kind of doing, really. The way it started was, it was after making A Close Shave, and we were ambitious to do something bigger at that time, and we'd been waiting for this opportunity. I was with A Close Shave out at the Sundance Festival and got a call from Steven Spielberg's company, from Jeffrey Katzenberg, Steven Spielberg's partner, and he sent his private jet to pick up me and my colleagues and fly us out to LA for a meeting just for one evening. And so we did that.
You can't just leave that one there. So you're sitting in the private jet.
Yes.
What do you do? Do you crack open Jeffrey's champagne?
I think we were a bit nervous. We were like, opening all the cupboards and, you know, trying to find glasses. And I think we did probably open a glass of champagne. But we're more thinking we need an idea to pitch.
Right.
And it was a more case of, Nick, you've got an idea, haven't you? What about that idea about chickens? And I happened to have it scribbled down on the back of a piece of paper. So it all seemed very, very attractive, and they seemed to really like what we did.
In terms of them understanding what you did, though, that's a slightly different thing. I mean, of course, it is a very, very British product that you make, even though it has this international appeal. I'm thinking particularly of almost my favourite line in The Curse of the Were-Rabbit, where a man complains that the giant rabbit has ravaged his wife's brassicas.
Yes.
And they tried to get you to take that line out.
That was one of the lines, yeah. There was, well, you know, you go through such a rigorous process. That's why coming back to the BBC and making a short film was so refreshing again, because, you know, every page is checked out by lawyers and you can't say this, you can't say that. That was one of the lines that they wanted us to take. We fought for that line and kept it in.
Thank God. But, what sort of things did they try to change?
I mean, I don't want to be unfair. I like working with Jeffrey a lot, actually. But there was a conversation at one point about, does he need that Austin A35? Is it a little bit too old-fashioned? To which me and Steve were thinking, well, that's why it's good. We were spending our time digging our heels in, and I think that can get a bit tiresome. Although in the end, you know, I think we're all happy with the end result.
Did it make you sort of rethink what it was you wanted? You know, the opportunity to make big-budget feature films, did it make you think, actually, maybe I am more of a sort of British handmade creation myself? Maybe I don't quite fit in the Hollywood hills, in among the private jets and the champagne.
Yes, I think there is that, actually. I mean, I never felt that we were manipulated or lost control, you know, on those films. There was enormous respect both ways, really, but there were fights, definitely. And I think it was more comfortable for us all in the end just to get out, really.
Let's have some more music then. Tell me what we're going to hear next. We're on disc number 6 now, Nick.
Well, I'm a great fan of Bob Dylan. Again, I think he's just a poet, really. Great, great songwriter. And I've chosen Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. I find it kind of intoxicating, the poetry. I'm just amazed by the power of words.
With your mercury mouth in the missionary times, and your eyes like smoke, and your prayers like rhymes, and your silver cross, and your voice like chimes. Oh, who do they think could bear?
Bob Dylan and Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. So, Nick Park, all of this great box office success must have brought you a degree of financial security. What do you spend your riches on? Why are you laughing? Has it not brought you financial security?
Well, I can't complain. The way I tend to think of it, it's great as an artist or as a filmmaker, you know, to be in a position where people want to buy what you do. I still feel kind of guilty, you know, that I enjoy it so much that I shouldn't be being paid for it.
But given that you are paid for it, you have to shoulder that burden.
Yeah. But the thing is, I have everything I want, really. I've got a lovely little house. I'm slightly expanding it at the moment. And I've got my camper van. And I love the British countryside. You know, I'm not after yachts and things like that.
So. You're not, yeah, because I'm thinking a camper van might have come in 30 grand tops. So I'm not... I've noticed with Wallace that over the years, romantically, he's become a good deal more confident. When he met with Wendell in Ramsbottom, he could hardly open his mouth. And yet when he encountered Paella Bakewell, you know, he was ready to fix her brakes at the drop of a hat. Yeah. Are you conscious of that?
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yes, he has. That was a kind of reference to Brief Encounter, which has always been one of my favourite. I'm a bit of a sucker for romance, you see, and romantic films.
Yes, you see, this is where I'm going. I'm wondering if there's a parallel here. I'm wondering if your own confidence has grown over the years.
It probably has grown, I don't know.
Are you one for the ladies? That's really what I'm asking, Nick Park.
I think I'm better at it than Wallace.
That's not saying much.
It's not saying much, really, no.
But are you good at relationships? Are you romantically involved?
Yeah, I like... I'm a romantically inclined kind of bloke. Yeah, I am, actually. Yeah.
Let's have some more music then. Tell me what we're going to hear next, Nick Park. We're at disc number 7.
Yes. Actually, probably one of the artists I listen to the most in the car is Van Morrison. And I just love this song. I love the album Poetic Champions compose. And it's a song called I Forgot That Love Existed.
Well, I forgot that love existed. Trouble on my mind. Heartache after heartache. Worried all the time. I forgot that love existed.
That was Van Morrison, and I forgot that love existed. It strikes me that Wallace and Gromit have sort of become the Morecambe and Wise of our age. You know, it's on Christmas Day, what we watch is a fat. Well, I think they're fabulous. Yes. A Wallace and Gromit movie. They get that sort of prime time slot. Mm. Does that sit well with you as a creative person? That's the place that they occupy in British culture?
Well, it's an enormous honour for them to be given that status. I'm not sure they live up to what Morecambe Wise were, you know. But it's a lovely thing, you know, that's what's happened. That's how they're perceived.
And the stamps, too. They're even on the front of our Christmas cards, yes. Yeah. Did you design the stamps?
I did, yeah. Yeah, it was great. I mean, again, it's an enormous process to go through, you know, where the Queen has to approve them and many levels of approval from the Royal Mail.
Of course, I probably shouldn't say friends with the Queen, but you do have a you have a relatively close relationship anyway. You've had lunch, though.
I have, actually, yes.
Actually sitting next to Her Majesty.
Yeah, it's about 3 years ago. I got invited for lunch with the Queen and the Duke. And there was about 10 people there at this lunch, and all the corgis. The corgis outnumbered us, I think.
Do you have to pretend to like the corgis?
I did like them, actually, and there's something to talk about as well, because
right.
She was kind of feeding them under the table with their digestive biscuits and telling me their names, and I don't know if you got time. Shall I tell you my story about the chocolate sponge?
Please do.
I'll try and make it quick. Well, I didn't really get to talk to the Queen until about halfway through the meal, actually, but I was always conscious that the Queen might turn to me at some point and talk to me. But eventually, when the pudding came for the dessert, this chap was one of the waiters, all with white gloves on, started pouring the chocolate sauce on some. And the Queen turned to me at that point and said, "Ah, that looks interesting, doesn't it?" You know, you're trying to make small talk. At the same time, your brain is kind of going, "It's the Queen!" She's looking at me. But anyway, I was trying to keep my cool and just make conversation. And I think I said something like, "Oh, I shouldn't eat all this chocolate." It was Easter next week, and I said, "Oh, my mother will probably be making loads of things like this, and I shouldn't really eat them." And then anyway, I had this kind of half-hour-long conversation with her, which was really interesting. She's very switched on and talking about theatre and films, and I wasn't wanting to stuff my face. So I think she must have thought that I wasn't liking the pudding. So she called the waiter and said, "Could you take this away, please? His mother says he shouldn't eat it."
Did you have to wrestle it from his grasp?
Because he'd been ordered by the Queen, he tried 3 times to take it off me. And I eventually won it back because I was really enjoying it. It was very good. But as if I eat what my mother tells me.
I'm going to cast you away on this desert island, Nick, of course. You will be alone. And might you try to escape? Will you fashion a raft? Wallace-like?
I don't know about a raft, actually.
A catapult?
It depends where I am, really, I suppose, what kind of island.
You'd probably prefer a Scottish one, wouldn't you?
I probably would. I love going up the west coast of Scotland. I've done that many times.
Would you try to get off, though? That's what I'm saying. Or would you be quite happy with your own company?
I would be very happy, actually, because I love doing a bit of mackerel fishing and camping and living off in the wild. I've always dreamt of spending a season, you know, on an island, you know, in a cottage.
Right, so you're practical.
No, I probably wouldn't last that long as soon as it got cold. No, I miss people, though. I once stayed on Iona off the Isle of Mull just for a week, and that really got to me.
And was that bird watching, or was that partially a sort of spiritual retreat?
It was a bit of both, really.
Right.
Yeah. And I joined in, there's the Iona Abbey, they had sort of pilgrimage tours of the island, and I joined in that, which was very enriching. Even though I'm very happy with my own company, but I like to be able to see people.
Let's have your last piece of music then, Nick Park. What are we going to hear?
This is a song by Joe Rose. He's the son of some very good friends of mine in Sheffield, artists in Sheffield that I was at art school with. And their son, I think, is a very talented, inspirational young songwriter in Sheffield. This is one of his songs called Plain Song.
That was Joe Rose singing Plain Song. Now, Nick Park, we come to the point then where I'm going to give you the books. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You're allowed to take a book of your own. What book's that going to be?
I think it's got to be my Collins bird book. Right. It's a bird identification book on birds of Britain and Europe.
It's yours. And you're allowed to take a luxury as well.
I think it would be my amazing pair of binoculars. I would never get bored looking at the wildlife, really.
OK, the binoculars it is then. And if you had to choose just one record out of the eight to save from the waves, which one record would you choose?
Well, I'm tempted to say Joe's song, actually, that last one, just listening to it now. But I think the one I play mostly, time and time again, is Van Morrison.
OK, it's yours, the Van Morrison, then. Nick Park, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Oh, it's been a pleasure and a great honour. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.